Hey folks, this Saturday, April 9th, 7 p.m., UCB Sunset, we're doing a live podcast about history's biggest badasses you've never heard of. Michael Swaim, myself, and a who's who of cracked writers and comedy talent that happened to be available that night will be telling you amazing true stories about lots of people. The Chinese woman who married a pirate, inherited his fleet of ships, and was so hard to kill that the British, Dutch, and Chinese navies all failed to capture her and eventually were just like, I don't know, you're forgiven, I guess? Pirating is legal while you're alive? Whatever, we're just tired of getting our ass kicked by you, lady. That's just one of them. We'll be telling you those stories and more this Saturday, tomorrow, if you're listening to this on the day it goes up, April 9th, 7 p.m., tickets for sale on the internet. Ticket link will be in the description on iTunes. Anyways, see you guys there. Hello, the internet, and welcome to this special bonus episode of the Cracked Podcast. We're going to be listening to three conversations I had with filmmakers down at South by Southwest. Up first, we're talking to a filmmaker named Jeff Nichols. He's the writer-director of Take Shelter, a movie I drove an hour to see in theaters when I didn't live near any that were cool enough to show it. Shotgun Stories, his first feature. Mud, which is the movie you're probably most likely to have seen. It starred Matthew McConaughey, started the McConaissance. Really lovely movie. It's basically a modern day Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer. I think it's legit an American classic. And I interviewed him the day of the release of his most recent film, Midnight Special. It's out now and is one of those movies that, like all of Nichols' movies, stays with you. I don't know if it's the best movie I've seen in the last year, but it's got a handful of the best scenes I think I've ever seen. And yeah, I'm a big fan of movies. If you listen to this podcast or if you watch the show After Hours I created with Daniel O'Brien, you know that. And Nichols is one of my favorite filmmakers working now. I've got a few who I like better who are out of work. No, I don't know why I said working. That's a thing pretentious people say to let you know they like a bunch of dead filmmakers. If I really wanted to be pretentious, I would have said he's one of my favorite American filmmakers currently working. Because then you know that I watch movies made by dead people and foreigners. Anyways, he is one of my favorite filmmakers working, period. And he's made one of the most interesting, most memorable movies I've seen in the past 12 months. And I spoke with him on the day it came out. I only had 20 minutes with him, so tried to fit a bunch in without getting intimidated by the fact that I was interviewing my favorite director. Hope you enjoy it. I'll be back afterwards to introduce the second director.
You, I'm sure, have answered tons and tons of questions about the filmmaking process. And something you've said is that you can't make a movie if it's not like something that you're already thinking about. So I kind of wanted to ask you about the things that it seems like you're thinking about when you make movies.
Sure.
I'm a big fan of those movies. And a lot of other people have done really interesting conversations with you about the filmmaking process. So I wanted to start with the South, which you're from the South, right?
I grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas.
And most of your movies take place in that general direction.
They do. Take Shelter was supposed to take place in Arkansas, but the producer that was helping put some of the money together was from Ohio and made me go to Ohio.
Do you consider like your movies to be Southern Gothic as a genre? Or that's
I always hear
head.
That term, and I've never... I don't
you
know
didn't
that
study
term.
That
no, I didn't study it. It makes me think of like vampires and crosses mm-hmm. and things. And so, no.
Wait, are you not the guy who makes True Blood?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Oh,
sorry.
No. Yeah.
I lived in the South for like 3 years. I lived in Kentucky. And mm-hmm. I felt like there's sort of this sense of magic. And Northerners might view it as like being more dull. But I think it's almost like they're more alive to certain things.
It's a few things. I mean, obviously, the most boring answer is write what you know, because that's not really it either. You know, I grew up in the suburbs at Little Rock. I was a suburb kid playing Nintendo and going to to watch movies. But my parents were from a really small town in Arkansas called Altimer. And so I got to kind of visit those places as a bit of an outsider, but I had inside access, you know, because my family was from there. So people treated me like I was one of the crowd. So I had kind of access to hearing all these crazy stories and accents and voices. And that's the kind of stuff I think about. I honestly try not to think too much about the way the world perceives the South. I think that's how you get into trouble. I think that's a direct path to affectation.
Yeah, it's just very authentic. I guess it kind of permeates your work more than
you try to. You know, it's like a temperance kind of when you're making this stuff, because all movies are fake and all movies are affectations because, you know, you have to come up with the clothes, you have to come up with the set dressing and the cars. But I just try to look around me and see what, you know, like what are rednecks actually doing? And, and you try and put that into a film, you know. You have these ideas that, oh, well, everybody's listening to country music and everybody's doing this, but it's like, no, sometimes they're listening to like death metal, and you know, it's like that opening like 5 minutes at Gummo, right? Seemed like they could happen anywhere in the American South.
Yeah, there's a really authentic conversation that happens in one of your movies, Shotgun Stories, where they're talking about like the top Arkansas basketball players, and they're like Corliss Williamson and I forget who the older player is.
They're also talking about basketball players that have had roles in other movies.
Yeah, that was a
and
great
I think
conversion.
They mentioned Charles Barkley in Five-O Goes West.
Right, he has a voice in Five-O Goes West, which is an incredible pull. That's true, right?
No, it's 100% not true.
Oh, it's
absolutely is not true.
Are you serious?
It was the actor who was playing the part actually just said that, and we just,
that's
so stupid and amazing. Yeah, I think he did a voice in Five-O Goes West.
You were kind of an 80s kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was born in
78.
And it kind of shows in this film. It really feels kind of like it has English on it from like lots of movies that I grew up on, like Spielberg movies. And
yeah,
I'm assuming a huge Spielberg fan.
I am, you know, from that period for sure. You know, I grew up in Little Rock where we didn't have foreign cinema. We didn't have art house cinema. This is what I thought going to the movies was. And so, you know, it makes sense to wake up now in my 30s and have this nice opportunity to get to make movies, to want to make a movie that felt like a movie I watched when I was a kid, you know? I mean, that's really where the kind of one-to-one correlations stop. It's not like I sat down and said, okay, and now this is when I'm going to rip off Close Encounters in this part of the movie. It was more just kind of a vibe, kind of a feeling of the kind of mystery and kind of the way those films hit me as a kid.
Yeah. You make as good use of like blinding white light in this as anyone I've seen outside of Spielberg. It's a really cool effect in this movie, but really reminiscent of,
I don't know if this is true, but, and how do you say this, but had Spielberg retired from directing when he was making Raiders of the Lost Ark, he could have been considered one of the top cinematographers working, you know, at the time. I don't know if that's true or not, but he had an understanding, I think, of light and of the film craft that was kind of undeniable in some of those early films, and the relationship that light has to the, you know, to the stories themselves.
He's the first person who light was the scary thing, whereas like up to that point, every kind of movie or, you know, even novel that you read, the darkness is the scary thing. But with Spielberg, it's the light.
Yeah, I mean, that scene with Richard Dreyfuss in his pickup truck, you know, getting flipped around. And even though if you look at the scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, when he puts the staff in the floor and the sun comes through that, you know, the top of that staff, I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's you have to know what you're doing to pull that off.
Yeah. And you definitely pull it off in this movie.
Thank you.
I've always wondered if the light thing is about the Holocaust. I like to bring everything back around to the Holocaust because this is a comedy podcast.
No, but wise.
You know, that obviously affected him. And that's something that happened in the light of day, like while everybody was looking, you know, it wasn't like a thing that like happened shut away. It's like the most horrifying thing in the 20th century happened, you know, while the world was watching.
A fair theory. For me, you know, I was just thinking about this movie and thinking about this kid who's obviously, and it's not too much of a spoiler, if you've seen the trailer, you see that he emits light from his eyes. You know that he's connected to some other part of the universe, and it seemed like, well, if he's somehow communicating with other places in the universe, other universes, whatever it ends up being, light seemed to be an appropriate language for that. You know, like the way we communicate with stars is they send us their light, and that's how we know they exist. So it seemed like light would be an appropriate language.
Yeah, it works extremely well. There's one part where like light kind of travels up his arm.
Right.
It's just really cool. You can like see all of the inside. I don't know. It's just a really, yeah, musculature. It's a really cool shot. But yeah, there's kind of a sense of wonder in your movies that I think feels very unique or at least rare. And that I guess I always kind of connected to the southernness. Maybe that's just a coincidence.
Well, certainly. It's not just like, oh, look at these dirt roads and pickup trucks. The way people behave is dictated by where they're from. It starts to define your socioeconomic status, you know, the car you drive, the job you have, the friends you have, what your friends do on the weekends. So much is dictated by where you're from, you know, that can't help but play into it.
Yeah, I never met so many people who, really smart people who legit believed in ghosts as when I lived in Kentucky for some reason. Like, yeah. Do you feel like that's true of like Southern people, that they almost have more of a openness to supernatural
mythology.
Things or, yeah, mythology?
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense to me. I mean, they're just really good. They're really good storytellers, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And they like telling a good story, and a well-told story is something interesting. It's not just about the punchline, you know, it's not just about the facts and laying the facts out in some pedantic way. The way you unfold it for people, I grew up running into relatives and they were just great storytellers. And
right.
They didn't have anything necessarily more important to say than somebody else. It's just the way they said it. That's a good lesson if you're starting to work in the trade craft of storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we didn't talk about awe. You were asking about wonder. There's this moment in Take Shelter when Mike's character standing on the side of the road at night, and there's this horizontal lightning storm happening in front of him. And I remember the first couple of takes, he was flinching and stuff, and it just wasn't what I had in my mind, but I'd never really been forced to enunciate what was in my mind. So I went up to him, and I was like, that's not quite it. And he's like, well, what is it? And, you know, am I scared? Is this stuff scary? And I was like, yes, it's scary, but it's, I think you're in awe of it. And then we did the next take, and it was awesome. You know,
right.
His head was back and his eyes were open. And I like that idea. I like that idea that movies that are really tight-knit and personal and specific to locale and specific to character can still take you to a place that might be awe-inspiring.
Oh, yeah.
That seems like a fair place to go. And it kind of reflects maybe a bigger worldview of things.
Yeah, I think it's an important place to go and a kind of underrepresented place to go. And
where these characters are going. It's
right.
Really important, you know. Plus, I really don't like, I don't like really depressing movies. Movies
right.
that are just depressing for the sake of it. Like Requiem for a Dream is a beautifully made film. But I don't ever want to watch it.
Right. Yeah, never.
I got through it once and was like, I'll never be seeing that again. Like
right.
Beautifully crafted.
Not super,
you know,
rewatchable.
Great filmmaking. But that's not the world that I want to live in. I want to live in a place where it can get pretty damn dark, but it's not hopeless.
Was addiction one of the things that you were thinking of when you were making this movie? Because you have like a couple real subtle things. Like quickly they like change channels past like Dr. Drew Pinsky talking about addiction. But then like there's also that character. Oh, was it really?
That was pure coincidence.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. Because there's also the character who's like kind of addicted to the feeling of or like needs to recreate that feeling.
No, not addiction specifically. And I thought a lot about addiction, but no. I was more focusing on belief systems.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was really thinking about each character as a representation of a mode of belief. You know, this is a sub-theme in the film. Ultimately, it's a film about parents believing in their kids. That's kind of the main form of belief. But no, I was looking at each of these characters as a representation of a type of belief. And I think as a writer, if you're trying to write characters that are holistic or you write them in their totality, you need to give them a worldview. And in order to do that, you're going to at some point have to say, well, does this character believe in God?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of a realistic view of if there was somebody with supernatural powers, they wouldn't be discovered on like a Ghost Hunters reality show.
Right.
They would be being like smuggled, you know, in the dark of night because the entire military would be after them and like everybody would. It's a really interesting thought. It's a giant leap of a question that you just take very seriously.
Well, sure. Well, and you know, that came through the research. I was reading these collection of articles at a Texas Monthly magazine. A friend of mine named Katie Vine wrote them, and they were all about the FLDS ranch out of San Angelo in El Dorado, Texas. It was the Warren Jeffs ranch. It was one of those.
Right.
I mean, just horrible, devastating stuff. I mean, the guy was marrying and raping 12-year-old girls, just really sick stuff. But there was an interesting fact when the federal government went onto that ranch to try and interview these people and find out how old they were and everything else. They had a very tough time interviewing them because there were no birth records of the children that were born on the ranches. So they didn't know if they were 12 years old or 15 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I was struck, you know, because I'm a moron, with the idea of, well, that could play in my sci-fi movie. Because if you have this these people kind of cloistered away on this ranch, there are no birth records. So if a boy was born with kind of supernatural abilities, he could go a pretty long time without the rest of the world knowing about him. So it actually – it allowed me to, you know, talk about belief and belief systems and religious dogma and all this other stuff. But it also just allowed me a really good end to get a kid to the age of 8 without being on CNN.
Yeah. I've also kind of done some research on Waco, and it's a similar thing there where, yeah, like they kind of
– it's amazing how much people are willing to give up of themselves just because somebody says they know what's going on.
Yeah.
So this is the funniest podcast I've ever been on, by the way.
It's left, right, right?
It's amazing.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that. One of the coolest things I've gotten to do on this podcast, or because of this podcast. Up next is a filmmaker named Linus Phillips, who made a hilarious and really heartwarming indie film that I watched and listened to. It's the story of a family with a mentally challenged young man named Chauncey, his brother, dad, his brother's girlfriend. It stars Melanie Lynskey, who you probably know as the wife from Togetherness, if you watched that show, who you probably didn't know has a thick New Zealand accent, like Flight of the Conchords, Daniel O'Brien impersonating an Australian accent, thick New Zealand accent. You'd never know it. She speaks perfect American English. And when, after the movie, she got up for the Q&A, I felt betrayed and misled, which I guess is an actor's job, but an actress, I mean, come on. No. It also stars Tim Sharp. You know him from Undeclared, also a part of the UCB Herald team Landlord, very funny actor. And the third star is the gentleman we're about to speak to, Linus Phillips, who wrote, directed, and stars in the movie. And it's one of those performances that I feel like would get nominated and win awards if they nominated, first of all, comedies, if they nominated comedies for Academy Awards, actual funny comedies. You know, not The Artist. Probably shouldn't say that The Artist wasn't funny. That dog runs Hollywood now. Anyways, yeah, if they nominated comedies and if Oscar campaigns didn't have anything to do with it. I don't know if people who don't give a shit about the entertainment business know that studios spend millions of dollars on political campaigns, like legit political campaigns for movies they think have a chance to get nominated. And since they're the ones who decide which of those movies to spend loads of money on, it's in their interest to see the movies they invested in get nominated. And so indie movies get frozen out. Anyways, weird screed against Hollywood in my introduction of a lovely movie. But it's been a while since I was at a film festival watching really interesting movies that I otherwise probably wouldn't have heard of. Maybe I would have. Hopefully this one takes off. It deserves to. By the way, I didn't love all the movies I saw at South By. You're just hearing the interviews with the people who made the movies I really liked and who were cool people. Anyways, Linus Phillips, super talented, super interesting, and we had an interesting conversation about his movie, which is full of dicks and heart, I think is the tagline we came up with for it. So, yeah, I hope you enjoy the conversation.
I'm joined by Linus Phillips, writer, director, star of Rainbow Time. Why don't you put in your words what Rainbow Time is and what it's about?
Rainbow Time is a movie I've been working on way too long, but it is also a story about this guy, Chauncey, this character I play, which actually I did in different iterations. I did him in stand-up and stuff like that. But Sean Z, he's this mentally challenged guy. He's got this brother, Todd. Todd, you know, loves Sean Z, but it's just grating. You know, Sean Z's a lot. He's
right.
He's very sexualized. He tries to live vicariously through his brother. So in the movie, Sean Z's trying to convince Todd to make a sex tape with his new girlfriend.
Right.
Because Todd made this mistake and showed him a little bit of a video he made with an ex. And he's got this new girlfriend who's very feminist and not really into that. So Sean Z keeps bringing it up and he has to move in with them temporarily. And it just kind of like pushes Todd to like confront this other side of himself and talk about things with his girlfriend that he really would have rather avoided.
My younger sister actually has Down syndrome. And you completely nailed the family dynamic between... You know, somebody with Down syndrome.
Wow.
And like, yeah.
That's great to hear.
Yeah. And
how old's your sister?
So I'm 36. She's 34.
Uh-huh.
I'm 35. She's 33. I forgot what my age was there for a second. And I guess you based this on like
I used to work yeah. with special needs kids. It's not really based on any person, but it's really inspired by those dynamics that I would see, you know, my relationship with some of the kids, the relationship with their brothers, relationship to, you know, their parents, and just like what a toll it takes on the parents, as amazing as the kids are.
Yeah. It's blunt honesty, sort of openly loving and like zero tact thing kind of all mixed together. And
yeah.
Yeah. It was really dead on, and like how that affects the people around them was super true. It's kind of like a destabilizing force in a family, but like one that is just pure love, you know?
What scene made you think of that dynamic?
Like, I actually, the parts where he would get sort of frustrated because he could tell that Sean Z knew what he was doing, but everybody else was like, oh, leave Sean Z alone.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, because like my sister is like my favorite person in the world, but she knows what she's doing. And she would like make faces at me behind like the back of like people who are like, you have to be patient. Come on.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was like that. Just sort of everybody else somewhat underestimating her and
yeah.
like everybody in my family knowing how high functioning she was and
yeah.
just being like,
well, to hold them to a certain level of responsibility means often being as angry or angrier than it looks like it's appropriate
right.
to be.
But yeah, I think that's true. Like having to sort of get patient at an early age, and also like seeing how people respond to her, my little sister, Caitlin, mm-hmm. was like sort of a divining rod for like, oh, you're good people. Oh, you're like a weirdo.
That's,
you know?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Right?
So you did Sean Z or like a similar character as sort of like a man on the street interview thing?
When I first started doing him, just I thought that was really fun. I mean, my favorite comedic person is Andy Kaufman, and
uh-huh.
you know, that just insane magic that he had was very inspirational to me. So like, yeah, just to go and not tell anyone and to not, you know, just
right.
to have that, let it be super uncomfortable.
Right.
But yeah, it was a great, like you said, a litmus test for people's quality of goodness, you know, like if
yeah.
they were really patient with me. And I would just like, yeah, I would do this thing where I'd hold the microphone out. Like I'd say, what's your favorite color? And then they would answer, and then I would just list all the colors in the rainbow, and I had it drawn on my t-shirt, and
uh-huh.
I'd look down, and as I looked down, the mic would keep going closer and closer to their face and like just be hitting them in the face and
right.
everything, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
Or I just like, after we finished the interview, I would keep talking to them,
uh-huh.
you know,
right.
and I would hug them and like ask for their phone number and ask to hang out with them. And tell them that I
right.
don't have any friends, you know, just go on and on. And then like they would walk away, and then I would go and follow them and walk to their car
right.
and stuff like that. That was just kind of me exploring and messing around. But yeah, it took years for me to like kind of go back to it in a different way.
Yeah. It's like, I guess Down's face, for lack of a better word, you're kind of like playing a character with Down syndrome, but I
yeah,
don't think
I
in
mean,
an offensive way.
I wasn't really trying to do that. It's just, I think I just naturally look a little bit like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, when I was young, I was called Corky all through high school. And
are you serious?
Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus.
I mean, cause I was a little chubbier and like my
right.
eyes are
right.
the shape of my eyes, but yeah, I really wasn't trying to do that. There was a certain gravelness to the voice, but I mean, I would hear lots of people who had different conditions and brain damage have a certain like attack.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Anyway,
I don't think it's offensive because I suspect that my sister would fucking love Sean Z. Like if she,
uh-huh.
if I could show her the movie, unfortunately, I don't think she'd be super into the, all the dicks.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dicks in the movie.
There's feelings
Very
and
funny.
Dicks.
Yeah. Feelings and dicks. But yeah, I'd love to do an edit on the movie with just cut the dicks out.
Okay.
Like replace them with walkie-talkies like E.T. And,
she would like that.
Yeah, see how she likes that. That's cool. So your background is kind of experimental theater, right?
Yeah, it's so conceptual. I mean, I started doing comedy again with this version of Shanzi where it's like a really bad comedian guy. And it's more like this version I did of him that's on Eastbound and Down. Uh-huh. And I got that because I started doing stand-up a few years ago again as that character.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah.
So you had a character that was like Shanzi on Eastbound and Down?
Yeah, yeah. But the Shanzi in Rainbow Time is more like this original character who's much more innocent and
sweet.
And it was originally called this guy Remus, but I changed him to Shanzi because he loves Fonzie. And so I was like, oh, that's good.
It was one of my favorite like names of a fictional character ever. Shanzi.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. The other thing,
I watched a lot of Happy Days shows.
Did you?
Yeah. I would like write down all the synopsises so I could like have them sort of memorized of the shows. I had this
For this movie?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to like kind of have that form, the base layer of like,
yeah.
Like if
anytime he wanted to just talk to a stranger, he'd be like, hey, do you know on episode 2 of Happy Days, you know,
right.
Like you would just like go into some long thing.
I saw an interview you did, I think at last year's South By, where you were here for Manson Family Vacation and you talked about having researched the Manson family a lot for that role.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like you do a lot of research for your roles.
Yeah, you have to do something. But then the what you do before the movie doesn't even feel like acting work. You're just like thinking about real things, you know?
Did you learn anything interesting about the Manson family doing research for that role?
I mean, just kind of the conspiracy theories are interesting.
What are the conspiracy theories?
You know, just that maybe it wasn't really Manson as much as this guy Tex Watson, who was like actually did the murders. Maybe it was more his idea, and maybe it was more about drugs, and who knows if Charlie was like actually invited to the Sharon Tate house beforehand for parties, and I don't know. And, you know,
he was invited, or
what? There's like theories about that, like he had just been over there, you know, and they all knew him or something. But I don't know. I mean, it makes sense that he would have been there at one time, because how would he have gotten the idea to like tell them to go there? Or if it was just the girls in Texas' idea.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't know. He's a mentally ill guy. He's
right.
Very, you know, crazy. He's very crazy, and it's sad. There's like a sadness to it, I think. I mean, it's hard to have sympathy for Charles Manson, but I guess that's what I sort of...
victim here.
yeah. He's the real victim, and everyone should just, you know, remember that. No, I would never say that.
No,
But that was my job as an actor, and so maybe to empathize...
The character was
my
like
character
a fan
was,
of
yeah.
Charles Manson.
Like. And I didn't want to just do it who's like... He's like a fanboy, because there's people online who just romanticize the vibe of it. It's like they love to go to Spahn Ranch and walk around where Charlie lived with the girls, because they romanticize it, but they're not romanticizing the murders. But it's just weird. Like there are these people I'm Facebook friends now with. And
oh, really?
Yeah. It's like I'm trying to be polite, but it's like I don't feel comfortable with like these people posting so many photos of Charles Manson, you know?
Oh, wow.
I mean, I know they're not pro-murder, but it just seems like you are when you do that. Like,
Don't...
If you have Charles Manson as your profile pic, you seem like you're pro-murder, you know?
At least that's a very honest way to let people know on Facebook what type of person you are.
Oh, my God, yeah. I think what's just interesting is just seeing this guy who's mentally ill, who's been in prison forever, and all those interviews, they're just wild. Have you seen them? Like where he's just dancing around and he's at one point he's like waxing poetic about the environment, and then he's like just gets really dark and angry, and you know,
mm-hmm.
But I mean, I've just said this before. He's like a shaman figure who's just like a deranged shaman. At points he could be like this guy who's got these great philosophies and, you know, and he's sort of not enlightened, but I don't know. He's got just something where it's just like he's seeing things in a cool way. Like, like if someone asks him, like, do you feel like you are loved? And he just flips it around and he's like, I am love. I have love inside of me. It doesn't depend on if other people love me from the outside.
Right.
I mean, that's like a beautiful thing. And he just says it in this way where it's just so like, sounds so true and resonant. And maybe it sounds cooler because it's coming from such a strange source. But then obviously then he'll just be rambling about World War II and how we're all locked into And just he says this crazy stuff where he's like, after World War II, war became crime. And it used to just be that crime was war. But when you put them on trial, war becomes crime. And it's just like, whoa. But it's like, you know, it's so meaningful to him. But right. You're like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, so you don't understand what that means.
No,
okay.
No.
That is interesting to think of him as like a shaman, like outside
but
of
like
the...
But like a broken one.
Right, a broken one, but like outside of the bounds of like Western culture... Like in other cultures, he might be like a shaman figure or something. Like there's a guy in China who started one of, I think, the deadliest war in the history of China, maybe the world, who was just like a cult leader who was like, I'm seriously Jesus, you guys. Mm-hmm. And everyone like followed him, like literally like a whole army followed him. And there is like something there. Like obviously there are like occasionally people like that who are broken shamans or...
Yeah. Well, the guy from Oasis thinks he's John Lennon, so...
But I mean, he... I think we can all agree he is, right? That's the first time I've seen that particular conflict brought to movies. The idea of like the lead character is in a relationship and he likes to film he and his girlfriends. And
oh, yeah.
But it's right. Which is like the way... which is the way that you would typically hear it. It's just like, oh, what a creep. But you like really treat it with a lot of thoughts. Like he explains what about it appeals to him. And it's like, right. It actually comes from a place of deep vulnerability, which I think a lot of creepy behavior does, you know? Yeah. But it was like really interesting.
I mean, it's something that I've been interested in, honestly.
Right.
You know?
So in the movie, he says like it's because he's afraid she's going to leave him. And so by filming her, he has something to kind of keep her with him even after she leaves or something. Is that kind of his justification?
I mean, yeah, that's like a simplified version. I think there's even, you could expound about it even more in real life.
Right.
To weird, embarrassing degrees.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah, it's embarrassing to talk about.
Well, expound upon it to weird, embarrassing degrees. This is a podcast. Come on.
Damn it. I feel like part of it could be that it's also just like an aesthetic thing where you're getting to look at you and your lover in a different way, almost like a mirror.
Totally.
Thing, which, you know, can be really exciting.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I love that there are just two other silent people in the room watching us do this.
We have engineer Brett.
Yeah. But I think there's probably that element of like almost imitating pornography, but unconsciously.
Yeah. I think it's inevitable. Like, I really honestly think that it was one of the more interesting and like honest depictions of a sexual relationship you really don't see. I've seen, you know, years and years of romantic comedies and like you don't see that issue raised really ever in an honest way, or like issues like that raised in an honest way. So it was really cool. You did a really amazing thing there. Well, yeah, everybody should see Rainbow Time. And anything else you want to talk about?
No, just get
your sex life a little bit more. You want to
dig
into that?
Yeah, I'll just talk about my sex life.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. Both of those conversations touched on themes that I've been thinking about in recent episodes. Jeff Nichols makes movies about poor people. We talked a few weeks ago about how rare that is, how unrepresented blue-collar folks are in movies. When I said that, I was specifically thinking of Shotgun Stories, which was really one of the very few movies I can think of about people really living in poverty. And then with Linus Phillips talking about how Manson might be a broken shaman, kind of ties to something Robert Evans and I talked about on this week's episode, about how mental illness is a recent invention and how what we consider to be mentally ill people were considered prophets and saints and shamans in other places and times. I'd say we're actually on a roll of pretty dope podcasts, if it didn't make me sound like a cocky douche. So I'll just say that we're straight crushing shit, bro. They're much better. Say, speaking of me sounding like a dick, this next interview. No, I sound fine in this next interview. I sound fine. I'm getting punchy, which is appropriate because we're about to talk about a movie called And Punching the Clown, which you'll notice doesn't make any sense as a grouping of words. You have to see the movie to realize why that's a clever and really funny title. But we're talking with Henry Phillips and director Gregory Viennes, who co-wrote the film. Henry stars in it. I think we only really talked to Henry in this interview. We talked to him about his career as a traveling stand-up singer, songwriter. It's a hilarious movie, sort of Curb Your Enthusiasm if Larry David actually acted like a real human being in that show. But yeah, it stars Henry and a bunch of my favorite funny people like Tig Notaro, Doug Stanhope, Mike Judge, other people I'm sure I'm forgetting. Henry Phillips is not somebody who I was overly familiar with ahead of the movie, but he and Greg are really funny filmmakers, and Henry's act, his stand-up act, is really funny. We'll excerpt a couple songs he performs as part of his act, and the movie has actually one of the funniest scenes I've seen in a movie as its climax, which is rarely the case. Comedy movies rarely build to the funniest scene. This one does. And yeah, you should seek it out. In the meantime, this is our conversation.
Well, first of all, Dan and Soren are here with
Hello.
Me.
Hello.
And
co-host.
Nope. No, you're not. All right, can we just cut him off? And we're joined by Henry Phillips, the star of and co-writer of And Punching the Clown, and his director, the co-writer and director of And Punching the Clown, Greg, can you pronounce your last name for me?
Viennes.
Viennes.
Pronounce the first name real quick for me.
Greg.
First of all, thanks for being with us, guys.
Thanks for having us.
We all watched the movie yesterday and thought it was hilarious.
Fantastic. Oh, thanks.
Really funny observations about Los Angeles and kind of the film industry in general.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that is kind of based in actual experience? And can you talk about those experiences at all?
Well, my main career is that I'm a live entertainer. You know, right. I go to comedy clubs. And then every now and then when you do that, you'll get a little taste of what it's like to either have a record deal or a TV development deal. And so Greg and I got a TV development deal based on our last movie, which was exciting. And the whole thing, it didn't go, our show. Right. And which you can tell by the fact that there's no show out
right.
there. So we learned a lot along the way, and then we had a lot of stories racked up to tell about it. You know, a lot of it is poking fun at how social media has become, I think, a little bit overblown. I think people yeah. are literally at the point now where it's like, well, Twitter followers are more important than thinking something's good.
We depend on social media for our livelihood and disagree with everything. We love you, Twitter.
I'd like to take
Facebook.
This time to point out that please subscribe. definitely. No, but that actually really resonated with me, the way that you guys did this, because I, as someone who has sort of come up from originally writing for magazines and then mostly, almost exclusively the internet, I have a knee-jerk disgust reaction when people get the internet wrong in movies, and I feel like you guys, either from experience or research, really got it right, that these meetings are happening where someone is like, yeah, we know that you're funny, but it only got this many this things
on
the internet, and it was just
you
like nice to see
1,000 jumpster connected pals.
Right.
Yeah. I always thought it'd be funny if there was a guy who was just social media but doesn't do anything. Like, for example, like if you saw his YouTube video, it would just be like, hey guys, I just want to tell you to follow me on Twitter and check out my Facebook. And then you go to the Twitter and it just says, hey everybody, subscribe to my YouTube and check out my Facebook. And then you go to the Facebook, hey, get on my YouTube and my Twitter and my Instagram. And that's all he does.
Oh man, they're the
snake eating its
what
tail.
Do you do? What do you mean? I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram.
You have no idea how many of those people actually exist.
Yeah, it really depresses you to know.
I know this because they criticize me on Twitter and then I like go to be like, oh, what does this person do? Is he a media critic? And it's like, no, he just tells you to follow him on Facebook. And where he tells you to
and
follow
then
him on Twitter.
If somebody criticizes him enough, okay, I'll do something. And then it's like, hey, everybody, I just saw the new Star Wars movie. It was good. Hey, but follow me on Twitter. And
I think probably, though, you do have a sense of virality because you've been doing Henry's Kitchen for a long time, right?
That's right. Yeah, I am a YouTuber.
Hello, and Welcome to Henry's Kitchen.
I really am.
Yeah.
There's just no lack of middle-aged men that for some reason want to teach you how to make chili from their bachelor sad apartment, and they always have flowery designs in the beginning with sad music, and then a smash cut to a guy just deer in the headlights looking at the okay, we're gonna talk about how to make chili,
shifting his weight from foot to
foot.
Yeah,
exactly.
The camera doesn't fit in the kitchen, so it's actually in the hallway, and you can see the walls leading to the kitchen.
No, those are a really fun release for me. I just felt like my entire life was just stagnant, and I was watching one of these cooking videos. I was trying to like learn how to make I think it was asparagus or something, and I saw this video and it just was making me laugh so hard. I was like, I gotta do one of these. So I made a French toast one.
Now it's time to slice our bread. We want to slice it up into manageable slices, and a common practice in the Middle Ages was that if a woman wasn't married by the time she was 20 years old, that was seen as a crime against religion, and then I guess she would be beaten into submission, or sometimes even tortured, or even executed.
And it's called Henry's Kitchen out there, if anybody cares.
You've been making it since 2011, right?
Yeah.
That's
a
long time to be...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really great. It's very, very tragic, and like it's almost too on the point. I notice also that you go and you occasionally talk to commenters in there as well. On that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That you interact with them. That's a bold move.
I have one called Henry's Vegan Free Gluten Pizza. And I had a lot of vegans. Yeah, I have a lot of vegan friends, you know, and they love the videos, whatever. But some vegans out there got really upset when they saw that I was... Well, the first thing they did, they were just like, who puts chicken on a vegan? It's not vegan if it's got chicken on it. This guy's got chicken, you know, and it's like... Yeah, no, it's vegan-free gluten pizza. It's not vegan, and it's got gluten in it.
That's
vegans in it.
I worry about
and
you.
And then they're like, but then why would you call it? Why wouldn't you just call it anything? Well, I want a recipe for something, so I'm kind of trolling them, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, the satire is so on point that clearly there's 60% of the people watching it aren't getting it. And it's it's so clear to me, and it's very, very, it seems very frustrating for you to have continued it for so long. I feel like... You've got a lot of things in your life. It's built around satire, and
I guess,
have to explain it to people.
I guess trolling is sort of like the new term for satire, you know? It's like, and that's kind of where my comedy act started from, too. It was sort of a troll. I used to love to go to coffee houses and see if people could think for 2 minutes that I'm just a regular singer-songwriter, and then all of a sudden the lyrics would start taking a turn, you know, halfway through.
How would they respond when you did that at, like, coffee houses? Would they laugh?
Yeah, it went pretty well. You know, that was the way the whole thing started. It was just because I was spending so much time in these music clubs and watching people do the real thing that I was like, that would be funny if all of a sudden this guy just started singing about this. Like, halfway through, we find out that it's not about that at all or whatever, you know. The bitch song... Where, you know, like Billy Joel has that great song about, you know, she lies and cheats and steals, but she's always a woman to me. Right. And so my song, which I performed last night, which was, you know, she was basically brought up in a great family and was never, you know, abused or anything. And
somehow she's a bitch anyway.
And yet somehow she's a bitch anyway. And so that was, that was one of the first songs that I...
You have a great one, Henry, that has a really slow burn that's a duet in which it's a love song. And it's between him and a woman. And he sings a whole verse about, like, meeting this woman in a checkout line.
I met a girl at the checkout line while I was buying a cantaloupe. And she was beautiful to me.
And how beautiful she is. And then she sings a verse about meeting this guy in the checkout line, how wonderful he is. And his name is Christopher.
Line while he was buying a pineapple, he said his name was Christopher.
Christopher, who the fuck is Christopher?
And the third verse is him being like, who the fuck is Christopher? And then it, like, deteriorates from there. It's really
that one's fun.
That's awesome.
There's like a real world version of that. There's this Plain White Tee song from a couple years ago called Hey There Delilah.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Love song, and it went huge, and someone interviewed Delilah and she was like, I guess I met him at a party once.
He's really into me. Yeah, it's creeping me out. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Call the police. Yeah.
With Hollywood sort of being the antagonist of it, I was curious, in your the many meetings I think that you probably had.
Yeah.
how often do they say to you, you know, we really like what you're doing, but if you could just be a little more high energy.
Oh, yeah. No,
that must come to you all
well,
the time.
Well, you know, to answer seriously, there's a very fortunate thing that's happened as a result of these movies, and that's that people are seeing what I do. And before that, they would go, oh, he's a comedian. He does comedy clubs. He's got a guitar. Maybe you could play the wacky guy on our, you know, in our commercial or whatever. And I would go in and audition for it, and I'd be terrible about it. You know, I auditioned for Weird Al's TV show a long time ago. He had a TV show, and I went in there, and they wanted me to be a guitar teacher. And so I was, like, teaching how to guitar for my audition, teaching how to play the guitar. And somebody who worked on the thing later told me, that the casting director said, never get that guy Henry for any more acting auditions.
Wow.
Yeah, so apparently it didn't go well.
Yeah, it seemed like in the movie, there's a funny guitar boy who feels sort of like your twin, Charlie Kaufman twin from Translation, where it's like the person that people expect you to be.
Being
like the really funny
guy. He's like, does it well. Yeah. But see, now the happy ending of this is that Mike Judge is actually a fan of the movies, and he's also a fan of my Henry's Kitchen, and so he just put me on two episodes of Silicon Valley.
Oh, awesome.
Which is coming up. I'm on episode 3 and episode 9, and I'm basically doing the Henry's Kitchen thing when you see it. So it's sort of like it takes a long time, but eventually people hopefully won't be telling me to be high energy anymore, because it'll be like, well, we already know what you do, and we wouldn't even ask you to be high energy. But yeah, that happened throughout a lot of my career.
I really do love and appreciate how the film sort of mirrors the way that your music goes as well, because it is such a fine line. Musical comedy, for I'm sure you've dealt with this your entire life, so people will say Weird Al, or they'll say much worse, because I love Weird Al.
Let's just put it this way. If you do a dry type of humor, you're going to have a really hard time following a guy doing Wasted Away in Diarrheaville, you know, because it's like,
that's
just something.
Good though,
yeah.
R.I.P. George Martin.
Write that down, Greg. Yeah. So it's just a different style, and it's very hard to compete in a world of that when you're trying to do something more subtle.
Yeah. I have a question about what I assume is in the movie. It might be the hardest song that you do, which is, what do you want me to do about it?
Oh, yeah.
I know that Clinton's getting nowhere with Congress. I know that unemployment rates are high. And I know that General Motors just shed 14% of its automotive components operations to accelerate the overhaul of unprofitable North American expenditures, resulting in the loss of nearly 14,000 American jobs. But what do you want me to do about it?
Now, I imagine you have to continually change that to keep up with new things that are happening.
Well, you'd be surprised. 20 years ago, I wrote that. It was about climate change, trouble in the Middle East, bad economy, unemployment. Yeah, exactly.
No, but you do.
There's a whole thing in there about General Motors. After a while, I was like, let's just let it sit in some moment in history and just move on with it, you know? But, because it's just too damn hard to write all that stuff.
Yeah, you've also got, are you trilingual? Yo sé que el mundo es loco. Yo sé que hay muchos problemas. Yo sé que las violaciones de los derechos civiles de los inmigrantes ilegales mexicanos por la policía americana demuestran los problemas que los ciudadanos de México tienen. Because you can do it in French and Spanish?
I am not, but, Greg is a Frenchman, so he helped me with the French, actually, and the Spanish, you know, I took it in high school. But yeah, no, French, I think I do all right.
You really nail it, yeah.
Cool.
Are there any, like, secretly great towns or, like, states that you think are, like, super underrated? Just
I don't know if they're
travels?
Secret. The first one that comes to mind is Fayetteville, Arkansas. That's a really beautiful place.
Really?
Yeah. Asheville, North Carolina, of course, but I think that's pretty popular now. And I'm in Austin here in a month.
Oh, yeah, you have to, like, say you like all towns because you travel there and you're still, like, selling tickets. You're like,
pretty
Austin's
much.
Great.
Yeah. No, Austin's...
Beloit's a shithole.
I'm trying to imagine somebody thinking Austin's a shithole. Like, who would hate Austin?
Please forgive me. I saw it last night. But the name of the town you go to is very specific when you leave L.A. What is the town in...
Oh, Ukiah?
Is that, like, a real pull for you? Is like, this is a place that I want to represent right now?
Yeah, I did a gig there. Sometimes we'll just sort of take wherever the original story happened and just make it that, you know, we just sort of never gets changed.
And Carson City also.
Yeah, Carson City, Nevada. And Ukiah. It's way up there, Humboldt County, I believe, and it's where all the pot farmers are, and people walk around just smoking joints, and it's no big deal. And
it felt really real, and a moment like that is really a teachable moment for liberal East Coast elite like me. I'm from New Jersey originally, and then have been in Los Angeles, and
elite New Jersey.
Yeah, very elite New Jersey. Yeah, listen to your songs, I'm like, this is subtle satire, and I get it. And then you go to this town I've never heard of, where you've got a guy who's wearing a bandana and a beard, and he's smoking a joint, and he's like tailor made for me to make assumptions about. I was like, no, Daniel, you're an idiot. This guy gets it too. Good comedy is good comedy, and you're not special.
Yeah, and that's even more and more the case now, because every town you go to, they're listening to podcasts, and everybody in a generation is listening to the same thing, as opposed to it used to be that, you know, in L.A. and New York or whatever, there was all some humor preferences, you know, Woody Allen or whatever, you know, and then you'd go into the Midwest, and then they would be all in a different thing. Whereas now, pretty much any comedy club I go to across the board, there's a whole group of 20-somethings that are all up to date on their Marc Maron, you know, and Louis and everything. You know, everybody's kind of on the same page, which is a big change.
Yeah, I wonder if that's why we were just learning that, like, the millennials are the most uniform as a generation. I wonder if it's because they're, like, the first generation that all had, like, the internet and
the
podcasts.
Same, yeah.
They're, like, they're all up to speed. Yeah.
It makes
they
a lot
share
of sense.
Their culture.
Even, it even crosses internationally. I mean, when I went to the UK, they all knew who Marc Maron was and everything like that. You know, so it used to be when you'd watch TV, if you went to the UK, you'd be like, what the hell is going on here? But I think more and more you're going to start seeing it become a little bit more uniform.
Right. It's such a difference from us growing up, where you're taping the errant comedy special on a VHS tape, or like listening to your dad doing a Bob Newhart bit.
Yeah.
Versus
now,
where it's like, oh, you can just listen to Louis talk to Marc Maron for 2 hours and it's free. Like, like everyone has that access.
It's amazing.
Now.
Yeah.
It feels like there's probably something lost there, though, that you don't, because you're not coming from a unique perspective anymore. I'm worried maybe about the youngest generation, because they're all coming up and they all know the same bits. They all know the same, they have the same sensibilities.
They all might sound the same.
Nobody's coming,
too.
Yeah. Nobody's coming from like a unique nobody's watching Upstairs, Downstairs and thinking that's the best show.
I think it's a legitimate fear, to be honest with you, that people will become more bland.
Yeah.
Or more.
Everybody
similar.
Being uniform is not necessarily the best thing in the world. I just
not good for comedy. Yeah.
I thought they were all diverse and had tattoos, but I guess the fact that they all have tattoos is weird.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You have a unique relationship to LA, like we were talking about, not just the industry, but like the city. Mm-hmm. Do you live in LA?
Yeah. I grew up in LA, but from 13 prior to that, I was Englewood, New Jersey, and New York City.
Is that New Jersey elite? Is that
Englewood?
You know what? For a long time, I wanted to say, since I was born in New York City and lived there for 8 years until we moved to Englewood, I wanted to say I was from New York, but New York people won't let me have that.
They're really,
they literally, no, you're not from New York. It's like, all right, well, I'll say I'm from LA, and LA people are like, well, you weren't born here. You moved here. Well, where the fuck am I from? Yeah. Well, that's why they say you're supposed to say wherever you lost your virginity, that's where you're from. So.
Fingers crossed
for
Austin.
Yeah.
The back of a horse.
I'm not from it.
Alright, that was our bonus episode. Thanks to Henry Phillips, Linus Phillips, no relation, Jeff Nichols, Soren Bowie, and Daniel O'Brien, no relation also. Two no relations in one list of names. Everybody's got the same last name. Who are we, Korea? Anyways, come to our live show. It's Saturday, March the April 9th. Anyways, I'll talk to you in just a couple days. Bye!
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.